Hello and what's happening, everybody? Welcome to the Wind Up Podcast. I am your host, Mike of MTGA Wines, and today is the June question and answer episode. It's the last few days of the month, which means we get to dive into some of the questions you all have posed either out at the winery during the visits and tastings we've hosted over the last month or so, whether you've slid into some of our DMs on some of our social networks in the comment section, whatever the case may be. We'll try and knock out a good chunk of them here today. Before we get into the questions that were posed and picked out for this month's episode, a couple of quick announcements as usual. Number one, thank you for continuing to subscribe, download, and listen to the show. It is very much appreciated. If you can and have a quick moment, please leave a quick review or one of those star ratings that helps with the algorithm and getting it kind of out into the airwaves a little bit more. Hugely helpful. Be sure to follow us on our social networks at MTGA Wines. We are most active on YouTube as well as Instagram. We are also on the Book of Face and the social network formerly known as Twitter, also at MTGA Wines on those guys. Without further ado, let's go ahead. One more announcement. You can also sign up for our regular newsletter on our website. You can go to mtgawines.com. We have all that information on the homepage, a little bit more information about the wines, what we do, who we are, all those things. All right, now we can move into the question and answer side of things. As usual, I'll be timestamping these. If you scroll down into the description of the video, read that at all, you'll see where those time breaks are. So if there's a particular question or something that you're most interested in, you can kind of cherry pick what you would like to listen to for this episode. We're going to dive right into one that comes hot on the heels of the most recent travel episode. So question number one, based on the travel episode, what are your error. Apparently I have not had enough coffee today, which those of you who have been listening for a while, you always know I have a cup of coffee here sitting on the desk because brain farts like that happen and I got to hit the reset button. So here we go. Three, two, one. Based on the travel episode, what are your recommendations for those traveling to Napa, whether we are first timers or have been to the Valley and multiple times? You know, this is something that we get asked all the time. I actually don't think I've ever kind of given suggestions on the show about kind of travel expectations to Napa, whether you're a veteran and been coming out here for years or you're trying to plan your first trip out here. Now, if you listen to the Vacation Hangover episode that we posted last week about our quick trip across the pond, you'll know that for ourselves, we're a little bit loosey-goosey with our scheduling and appointments and all that kind of stuff. We typically kind of have one main stopping off point or destination or thing to do in a particular day, and we build the rest of the day around that somewhat haphazardly. We just kind of like to explore. Now, there are some tricks when it comes to wine tasting in the US and specifically in Napa versus how it's done in Europe, although it's kind of starting to change over there. Number one, many folks will tell you, and if you've had friends that have come to Napa or you've been here before, you know that not that long ago, it was pretty easy just to walk in or drive into wineries, taste a couple of wines, maybe buy some bottles, and then take off. It wasn't necessary to have appointments. You didn't necessarily need to call ahead for anything. You can just kind of map out your day and go where you wanted to go. That is no longer the case. For restaurants as well, Napa has only gotten busier. There used to be a time where it was a lot easier to find kind of bar seating. And you could just kind of walk through Yountville or downtown St. Helena or Napa and be like, all right, there's a couple open seats at the bar. We'll just grab a quick bite and call it good. It is getting tougher and tougher to do some of that stuff, specifically when it comes to visiting wineries. That is typically more, it's by appointment almost exclusively in the Valley these days. But that's for a couple of reasons. I'll dive into those just a little bit. So my number one suggestion when it comes to visiting Napa, kind of building out your itinerary, is one, have those couple of appointments dialed in. Typically, you can book online. Even that's what we do. We have just a quick form you fill out with some details to book your tasting appointment with us, and many wineries will have something similar. Or if you're one of those people like me that prefers to call and get a little bit more detail, go for it. Typically, that's pretty easy to do. Send an email, carrier pigeon, whatever you need. Maybe not the carrier pigeon. I did just finish watching The Gentleman on Netflix. And I was like, oh, there we go. Little blast from the past action. Spoiler alert, not really. I mean, it's just like one scene in the last episode, basically. That doesn't really have any bearing on how it actually plays out. But they use carrier pigeons. Fun fact. Anyway, just book those appointments ahead of time. You know, for some of the bigger wineries, you can probably go online and figure out, hey, is there like a walk-in experience? Maybe we're just going to be up in St. Helena for lunch, and maybe we just want to catch like a wine tasting or two and keep it a little bit more casual. Do a little bit of research. This is certainly a place because of the reservations that you need when it comes to visiting wineries. There are a lot of small brands like us where if you don't call ahead, we're probably not going to be out there, you know? There's only so much cellar work that we have to do. We're not there, you know, 9 to 5 every single day. So if you happen to not plan ahead and not give us a call, we'd hate for the gate to be closed and you just can't come in. Like that has happened a couple of times, which is why we ask for an appointment. It's like, hey, just make sure that we're in town, you know, so that we can meet you out there. So when it comes to the winery side of things, making those appointments ahead of time, or at least doing a little research on where you're going, is huge. You know, it's very different in Europe. It's starting to change a little bit where more wineries are kind of welcoming guests, but that what we call in the industry direct to consumer, where we have kind of these hospitality offerings at wineries, is a relatively new phenomenon, both here and especially there. Because most wines are still sold through, you know, distribution. They're still sold through retailers and restaurants, specifically retailers, you know. So with that in mind, this whole hospitality wine thing, we're still kind of flying by the seat of our pants. There's a lot of great experiences out there. There's a little something for everybody depending on what kind of trouble you want to get into, but it does really help to plan ahead. Now, when it comes to wine tasting, realistically, don't plan more than 3 in a day. If you book 4, you're going to just be hammered and you're going to have to cancel your dinner reservation. Believe me, I've seen it happen. It's a tough scene, all right? So even if you're coming back and you want to cram in as much as you can, understand that it's at least have a picnic lunch or a sandwich or something you can enjoy in the car if you're just go, trying to pack in as many wine tastings as you can. Because even though they're tasting pours, maybe a couple of ounces of each wine, you do a few of those throughout the day, it still catches up with you. So my trick of the trade is like, you know what? Let's do 2 in the morning. It can be a little early, but hey, let's have a little breakfast around, you know, 8:30 or so. Let's get out and hit our first wine tasting at around 10, maybe 10:30, maybe hit one more after that. And then by, you know, 1:30 or so, let's have 1:32, let's have a break for lunch. You know, let's do, you know, whether it's a picnic lunch or you're coming back into town, whatever the case may be, carve out maybe an hour and a half for that. And that way you have the option of maybe adding on one more wine tasting after that, or you just have the rest of the afternoon to kind of like kick back and relax. Honestly, that's my ideal schedule. But again, no more than 3 wineries. You know, as much as I would love you to pack in as much as you can, it's a much easier going pace. You don't have to worry about running late to places, and you don't have to be worried about missing your dinner reservation. I've seen people cancel reservations at French Laundry at the last minute because the day was just too much for them. And I would hate for that to happen to you. Now, when it comes to the restaurant side of things, highly recommend, you know, booking that in advance as well. There are plenty of amazing places. You really can't go wrong. If you're trying to get into the French Laundry, it's hard. You have to be like online the moment reservations become available. You can't just call them a couple days ahead of time and get one. Every once in a while, this is a trick of the trade, and I know a couple of people this has worked for. And to be fair, like dining at French Laundry is not for everybody. You know, spending that type of coin just to sit down and eat is not necessarily for everybody. I get it. But if you're a foodie, you want to sit down and experience what TK is doing out there, it is a great experience. It really is. But sometimes if you're like, you know what, let's be a little whimsical, you can call them like the morning of, because they typically do a lunch, if I'm still remembering. So if you can call them right as they're getting going for the day and just be like, hey, we know it's a long shot, but if you have any cancellations, can you let us know? And every once in a while it works. I don't know how often that works anymore, but I know people that have done that in the past and it's worked like a charm. I'm not saying it's foolproof, but hey, there's your option. For any other restaurants, you can typically go on OpenTable, Talk, or just the restaurant's website and book right there, and you'll be all set and ready to go. I will say, the sooner you do that, the better, because of how busy, again, the Valley is getting. Restaurant reservations can be tougher to come by, especially for larger groups. And I should mention this for the winery side of things as well. If you're traveling with 6, 8 or more people, there are a lot of places, especially on the winery side, that will tell you, sorry, no, we can't host you. A lot of these businesses are pretty small. They don't have a space to host big groups necessarily. So that's when it's worth sometimes giving them a call, because you might not necessarily see that option online. It's worth having a little discussion with them to see if you can figure out if it's something you can actually do. And if not, you know, no harm, no foul. You've tried and find another place. Larger groups are tough for us to accommodate. It's just kind of the nature of the business and the space that we have allotted. Like, we can technically sit like 8 people at our tasting table, but you're crammed in there. Like, there's not any room to really maneuver or do anything. So typically we book groups of like 6 or less. There are always exceptions for many, many folks, but you know, big groups can be a little tough. So I hate to burst your bubble if you're planning the big like weekend away with friends and family. It can be a little challenging in that sense. And of course, I think we all know like getting restaurant reservations for big groups can also be a little tough at times. So if you're planning things with a large group of, and I'm saying like 6 people or more, you better jump on it early. You better start making some phone calls and some reservations, because it can get really tough to dial that in. I don't want to dissuade you from planning a trip out here like that, but it, you know, it just takes a little bit of extra oomph to get you over the hill to make sure that you got everything dialed in. And we all know, like, the bigger the group, it can be like herding cats. So it's nice to get that all booked, settle down, and that way you can just get out here, have fun, and enjoy yourselves. When it comes to lodging and whatnot, I will be honest, the hotel scene out here is a little outrageous right now. Post-COVID, a lot of the hotels here are very content sitting at like 30% capacity, but charging like 2 or 3 or 4 times what their normal rate is, which sucks, because for you guys, that makes it very expensive per night. If you can find a great Airbnb, you know, a house that you can rent honestly with a group of people and kind of split that cost up, I highly recommend it. It's probably the best way to go right now. If you're looking for that resort feel and you want to go to Solage or Auberge or whatever the case is, I mean, have at it. No harm, no foul. You do you, bae. But if you're trying to, you know, be a little bit economical so you can spend a lot of money on food and wine, then you probably want to search for some sort of alternative. There's also some great bed and breakfast type setups out here. It's, again, not necessarily your usual hotel amenities. But damn it, if you're like me and you like pinching pennies so you can spend your money on experiences, that's how we operate. And it's a way that I suggest that many people do when you're traveling out this way. Highly, highly suggest it. If you are a little bit more of a planner, again, you can dial this in as much as you want. Or if you're a little bit more whimsical like us, you can say, we have this winery appointment and this lunch, and then after that, we'll figure it out. So you can really kind of pick your poison still and figure out what you want to do and where. Or you can have a really dialed in, like, hour by hour itinerary if you want. For those that don't do this or haven't done this, I do highly recommend getting a driver of some sort, some transportation to drive you around. If you're going to be drinking wine all day, it's going to be way cheaper than potentially getting a DUI. And you can actually enjoy yourself. You don't have to worry about somebody kind of holding back. It does mean you're spending a little extra money, but hiring a driver to get around the valley is the way to go. Uber and Lyft still are not super reliable unless you're frequenting the towns. But as it gets later in the evening, that really kind of stays in downtown Napa. And as you go further north, even to Yountville, especially to St. Helena and Calistoga, it gets really, really tough to find that rideshare service. So, you know, keep in mind kind of your locale. You're dealing with some very small kind of country towns when it comes down to it, even though this is a very popular place in terms of tourism. We out here, you know, things start rolling up shop pretty early. And as a result, kind of the main city, downtown Napa, is where a lot of the liveliness is as you get later into the evenings. Our small towns, like we are, it's a little bit quieter, a little bit more mellow. So as far as getting from like point A to point B, just something to keep in mind. I think that's really kind of all the tips and tricks. Realistically, it just plan it. You'll have a good time. Don't worry about it. Long story short, just plan it. You'll be fine. And if you haven't been to Napa recently, it's still a lot of fun. You should definitely come back out. All right. Into question number two. Let me go ahead and tap this in real quick, like. All right. How do we think the 2024 growing season is going? You know, it's not that it's too early to tell. I'm really liking so far the weather patterns. It's a little bit more typical so far, kind of early summer for us, where we're having these days where we're getting into kind of the mid 90 degree range, and then it's cooling back off at night. I mean, we're still seeing like 90 degree weather during the day, but it's getting into the 50s at night. So we're seeing this great diurnal shift, which is perfect for the vines. It's been dry ever since kind of the winter wrapped up. We had another good rainy season this year. Right now, everything's looking pretty good. We got through bloom. The grapes have all been pollinated. You're starting to see them kind of pop up on the vines now. They're still very green and very, very, very underripe. For like your reds, they won't start changing color here for a little while still. But fruit set looks good. It looks like yields are going to be, at least for our vineyards that we work with, it's looking like they're going to be in a really good spot. Probably at least average, if not a little above average. Again, I haven't seen a lot of issues in terms of like shatter, which is just a problem with the pollination process where you didn't have some of those flowers pollinate correctly and you have like very sparsely populated grape clusters. And as a result, your yields go down. It seemed like everything trucked along really well through kind of our bloom season, which is great, which means we should have good yields this year as well. All in all, very happy with how things have started. You know, we've got a long way to go until grapes start coming in. Very typically, our first grapes don't come in until the last week of August, maybe first week of September. So it's not that far away, but we are talking like a solid 2 months. 2.5 months before we really start getting into the thick of the action. And there's a lot that can happen between now and then. Based on the last few years, 2021 was outstanding. 2022, we did have a very wicked heat spike, which was challenging, but I think many of us got through it the best that we could. We're bottling a lot of those wines up now this year. 23 was outstanding. Last year, it's going to be tough to beat. It was one of the better growing seasons that we've experienced. There's a lot of people comparing it to, you know, something like 1997 or a 2012, potentially, you know, kind of some of these iconic growing years for Napa that really stand out in the moment. I'm still holding my breath a little bit to see how these wines actually evolve in barrels since they're still very, very young. But it's been a good stretch, a very good stretch for a few years. So all of us are kind of like knocking on wood right now, hoping that that just continues. It is farming after all, so anything can happen. Mother Nature can be a pill. Hell, even this morning, it didn't rain, but it was like drizzling a little bit. I'm like, this is something cool. Maybe this could like spice things up a little bit. Luckily, it was barely enough to like knock the dust out of the air. It was not going to be a problem, but that kind of stuff can happen. It's rare, but it does. So 2024, so far, so good. You know, the jury's out on how it's going to wrap up. But, you know, if this summer continues just like this and it stays fairly temperate as we get into the actual harvest season with no big heat waves or rainstorms, it's going to be another beautiful year. So no complaints so far. I know that's kind of like the long and the short answer of it. It's like, yeah, it's moving. It's good. We're happy. We're doing all right. Things are trucking right along. You know how it goes. All right, question number three. So this was a question from a buddy of mine. Shout out to Sean and Lauren who came on out to the winery over the weekend. We talked a lot about this. And it's something that I think Karen McNeil posted on her Instagram page maybe last week or the week before as well, kind of diving back into the wine additive conversation. And the question was, is there any incentive for wineries to start to disclose what additives are actually going into their wines? And the short answer, I should say, is no. This is something that I think we talked about in our wine additive episode last year. We've mentioned it here and there, is that very typically for wineries that start kind of publishing this information, like on their wine bottles, like almost like a table of contents, many of them have seen sales decline rather than consumers be like, oh, this is great. They're sharing more information. For what reason? I don't know why. It's such a weird trend. You think that people are like, oh, they're being more honest and upfront about what's going on here. But for some reason, the opposite has tended to happen. I believe Karen McNeil pointed out that Ridge, you know, a very iconic producer out here in California, was using some of their bottles as an example of, you know, hey, here's what we use in our winemaking. That's actually on their label, which I think is great. I'm one of those people that believes that wineries need to be doing this more. We need to be having this conversation more. Consumers need to know what is actually in this beverage that they're consuming. It's not just grapes 99.9% of the time because of how much wine is just mass produced and overproduced these days. So this is something that's very kind of near and dear to my heart and something that we've talked a lot about on the show. But what's a bummer is that there's really no incentive for wineries to be upfront and honest about this. And this will be a little bit of my own soapbox here, but we have to rely on consumers like yourselves listening to this to start to push this boulder up the hill a little bit with us, because we can keep providing as much information as we can. But, you know, if it's not something that people are clamoring for, then it's a wash. It doesn't really matter. And I think many of us understand that we live in essence, a fast food nation. A lot of people don't give a shit about where their food comes from. They just want to know that they can go to the grocery store and get that steak out of the, you know, produce section and some lettuce and make a steak and salad tonight. They don't really give a shit where that farm is, where that beef came from. They don't care where that lettuce came from. They just want it to be available. You know, there are many people, you know, and this is maybe this is just a like a city living or a California thing. And this is a little bit of a tangent, but you know, I grew up in a family that has a hunting lodge up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And when I was 9, it was my first trip up there. And at that time, that was when I learned where food comes from. Because guess what? You get to shoot a gun and gut your first deer. And all of a sudden, you have a very intimate, you know, relationship with how food is actually brought into, you know, a grocery store. And there are a lot of people that are like, oh, I don't want to think about the cow that this used to be because maybe it had a name and maybe it was really cute and this, that, and the other thing. And yeah, you might be right. It probably was a cute cow, but it's also delicious. I still joke, you know, that the cuter the animal, the better it tastes, right? But, you know, there's such a dissociation with, you know, where a lot of what we consume comes from in this kind of globalized world and economy, that it's kind of a bummer because people have become desensitized and they're like, oh, maybe it's not that people don't care, but it's just like, oh, if there was something wrong, we would know about it. We would see, oh, there's a recall at this retail shop for this particular, you know, bag of lettuce or this beef or whatever. And we don't have to worry about that kind of stuff, which is, I mean, probably kind of nice to a certain degree. We know that our food's at least of a certain quality. But part of this conversation led into this gal. She was asking, you know, how do I know, like, if I'm shopping for produce in a grocery store, not even wine, not even grapes, but if I'm shopping for produce in a grocery store, how do I know that, like, herbicides and pesticides haven't been used on it? And I'm like, that's a hell of a question. You know, if that's something that you would concern, that you're concerned with, then realistically, you need to look for produce that has that, you know, certified organic, you know, certification on it, which a lot of, you know, small farmers, a lot of people in the wine industry don't get because it's hard to get. Number one, it's very expensive or can be very expensive. And they will, in essence, practice it as much as they can, but just never get the certification. Right? Like that is very much a thing. But if you're really worried about that kind of stuff and what you're putting into your body, then yeah, buying organic, even though it's more expensive, is worth it. It just is. Also, for those that are worried about like GMOs and things of that nature, if it's certified organic, it means it's non-GMO. That's how part of that certification works. So you can knock out some of that non-GMO stuff as well. Kind of a nice way to kill two birds with one stone, if you will, when you're shopping for produce. Now, when it comes to wine, it gets tricky because you can farm organically. Like the farm you're sourcing grapes come, and actually we're so happy to, actually this will be the first time I've talked about it. One of our farmers is converting their entire vineyard to organic over the next couple of years. And it is a process, it takes time. And they've been doing everything to kind of make this next jump for the certification, which is why we've been working with them. They are very focused on sustainability and health of the land and farming and creating great produce without the use of, you know, nitrogen-rich fertilizers and, you know, pesticides and herbicides and things. They've done a great job, which is why we love working with them. And it was cool to see them be able to take that leap. But even if you're using that organic produce, you could still create a wine that you can't label as organic. And the reason is because of some of these different additives that we're talking about. So, you know, it's kind of like best laid plans, right? Or best intentions. But guess what? We're going to manipulate this wine in a way on the back end in the cellar that's going to make that, you know, in essence, a moot point, you know, like a cow's opinion. Just doesn't matter. Hats off to Joey Tribbiani. Anyway, it's really tricky. And with not a lot of incentive for wineries to start disclosing some of this stuff about how their wines are made, we're kind of stuck between this rock and a hard place. You know, very anecdotally, it's been my experience that more and more people are curious about this kind of thing because they're worried about their health and their wellness, and they enjoy wine. So, you know, how can I be healthy and still enjoy wine? You know, because alcohol can cause problems for people. You know, it's something that, you know, if you're consuming it in excess, can cause all kinds of problems. So where's the line? And how can you, as a consumer, kind of have the knowledge you need to be able to make a good, like, educated decision when you're shopping for wine? It's really tough right now because a lot of wineries simply won't disclose this information, and there's no incentive for them to do so. So, you know, I don't want to put, you know, the onus on just wine consumers, but at a certain point, people need to really buy in and get a little bit more in tune with what they're actually consuming. Because this is, you know, there's a clean wine brand that one famous actress and business partner started, and I ended up hosting like one of their investors years ago. This was forever ago, and we got on the same topic, you know, about additives, and good on them. They were trying to say like, hey, you know, we're making quote clean wine, which is like the marketing buzz term at the time. Never really caught on, but sure, why not? Have at it. There's also no regulation behind that. It's literally just a marketing term. It's like the word reserve. Technically, it means nothing. You can just use it and whatever. But good on them. They seemed to be doing a good job of like disclosing a lot of their processes and what they were using to make their wines. And we got on the topic and I was like, by the way, did you know that I use half as many like processes in my winemaking? Like some of them, those like four things that I do, you also do, but then you also do like four more things. And he was like, really? I'm like, yeah, turns out. And it was my little bit like, I'm just like poking the bear. Like, is my wine cleaner than yours? Hey, is my wine cleaner than yours? Is my wine cleaner than yours? I don't know how well he took it. He had to buy some wine. So shout out, if you're listening, hats off, you're a champion. Thank you for letting me razz you. But that's the kind of stuff like within the industry we're talking about, more and more folks like yourselves are asking these questions, and we're hoping that between, you know, when our powers combine, that we can continue to really kind of kick this door open and let people know like, hey, there's a lot of fuckery that goes on behind the scenes of winemaking. You could be in essence drinking a Big Mac in terms of its overall quality of produce, but you would never know because we don't have to legally tell you. Which is why many of us are doing more to disclose more of this information and be a lot more open about it and have this kind of conversation with people. So we're hoping that through talking through this with folks that we can create more of an incentive for wineries to disclose this information. We'll see if it works. I think this is going to be an uphill battle for some time. There are a lot of people in a lot of big companies with a lot of lobbying power that want nothing to do with this conversation. So that is going to be something that is going to be, interesting to overcome, to say the least. Okay, on to the next one. Here we go. For small businesses, and this goes back into the business side of things, which I always love talking about. For small businesses, small wine businesses specifically, how do you market yourselves? Is it a combination of ratings, reviews, advertising? What works for you? Well, what works for me doesn't necessarily work for everybody, right? And every company kind of has their own style of what they want to be known for, or what they're doing, and how they're kind of marketing themselves. In this era of, you know, specifically kind of online advertising and social media advertising, it's interesting because, you know, the news cycle is so fast. You know, right now we're still in the throes of the Haktua girl. Like, she's just having at it right now, having her moment, right? And in a week, it's going to be completely different. You know, someone else might say something stupid with a man on, or hilarious in this particular case, with a man on the street, like, interview. You never know what's coming around. So it can be really tough to capture people's attention, number one, because it just moves so fast. And if that ad cycle kind of blows by you, you might not even see it. Or you just might have people doom scrolling on, you know, whatever social media app they prefer to use, and they're just, you know, trying to avoid the ads as much as possible. You could be doing events around the country. You could be doing tastings and tours and looking into referral sources between, like, hotel concierges and travel agents and all kinds of other things. You could do more traditional print advertising or ratings and reviews and things of that nature in the wine industry. And for any small business, you just have to figure out what works for you. And honestly, you need to find something that is hopefully unique. You know, I typically rely on, I don't want to say it's like countercultural necessarily, but definitely doing it differently than anybody else. You know, we've never done any traditional print advertising, ratings or reviews. Hell, we've never even bought ads on any of our social networks. We do events around the country, do tours and tastings. We rely on referrals and kind of this very much like grassroots style of marketing, because it's been my experience, whether it's been for wine or any other consumer good, a personal recommendation from a friend goes way further than a paid advertisement you see on Instagram, right? I think there's probably a few of us out there that have, you know, clicked on some clickbait, bought a product, that product shows up, and you realize it's actually trash. It's poorly made. It does not fill the function it says it does. And you automatically regret spending that money. So that's not the lane that I wanted to put, like, our wines in. But nor did I want to go the more traditional route. Number one, if we go, like, print, you know, in insert, you know, wine publication here, I don't care if it's the Wine Enthusiast, Wine Speculator, the Advocate, whatever it is, that ad space isn't cheap. The last time we were actually offered a deal from one of those publications, be like, hey, here's like a great deal on, you know, this, you know, like 2x2, whatever square advertisement on this page. You'll share it with a few other people, but hey, we're going to run a special on it. It's only going to cost you, I think it was like 10 or 15 grand. And I was like, yeah, no, absolutely not. I would rather buy grapes with that money than pay you that 100%. It was a joke. But I understand, you know, for certain big producers, they have a marketing budget and they need a presence. They need eyeballs. They need butts and seats. And they'll gladly spend, you know, 15K on a, you know, quarter page ad, because that's what they do. Ratings and reviews. Ratings are far less important now than they ever have been. You know, there's a lot of great wine out there. They're giving away 100-point ratings like hotcakes these days. Not to say that those wines aren't very good and well-made, but, you know, the day that ratings and reviews are accompanied by advertising space in those publications, that's a huge problem. There's a reason why Robert Parker was kind of like the gold standard, is because the Wine Advocate didn't used to have advertising. It was a pure, here are the wines, here's what I think about them. Whether you agreed with it or not, at least, you know, he didn't sell his soul to, you know, who was paying him for ad space. Because it is weird every once in a while, having worked for large companies, small companies, it's weird that when you see you see like higher than average scores for businesses that advertise in those publications. That's crazy. It's just coincidence, right? That couldn't possibly be related, right? Absolutely not. That would never happen. There's a little bit of cynicism within the wine industry for you, just to add a little spice to the conversation. So realistically, I mean, when it comes to marketing yourself as a small business, you got to figure out what works for you. You also can't sit back and wait for something to come. You have to be proactive. You know, you're seeing it in a year like this where there are a lot of wine businesses last year that were down in sales. There's a lot of wine businesses that are down this year in sales. And you have a lot of people who I think rested on their laurels after a really big 21 and a big 22. And they're like, it'll be fine. And now it's not fine. And they're fighting and scratching and clawing, trying to find ways to get back into the game and get back to where they need to be, whether that's on the wholesale distribution side of things or whether that's on the direct sales side of things. You're seeing this, you know, rocky period within the wine industry right now. And a lot of us are saying like, this is going to, you know, this is a huge gut check to for people to decide whether you're pretending to be in the wine industry or you really want to be in the wine industry. Because it's tough as it is already, but when you hit these rough patches, it feels like the end's never going to come into sight. You know, you're never going to see land again is what it feels like. There are days where it feels like, man, I'm just never going to sell another bottle of wine. It happens. And you get super down. I get super down on myself probably a couple times a year. It happens, you know, typically December into January and right about now. I start getting really nervous because I see harvest around the corner. I see a bottling run around the corner. I know what those expenses are going to be. I know we have a club shipment. I know we're going to see visitors between now and then. I know we're going to be selling wine on the road. But as it looks like every year, it looks like an impossible mountain to climb. And we have to find a way to market ourselves correctly so that we can climb that mountain by selling wine. It's what you have to do to survive. And there are years where some things work. There are some years when a lot of things don't. And the key is to keep throwing shit at the wall to see if it sticks. And once it does, hit it hard and hit it fast. Have your moment with whatever that tactic is, because with that very quick cycle that we have now when it comes to marketing and sales, that might be gone. And if you can't turn on a dime and capitalize on something like the Haktua girl, then hey, you're in a whole world of hurt. You need to be able to move fast in this day and age. And if you can't, it's going to be very, very hard to keep up. So find out what works for you. Do not be afraid to experiment. And if something's working, figure out how you can get better at it, iterate, and do something different than your competition. Because if everybody's doing the same thing, I mean, email marketing is a perfect example. Email marketing has fallen through a huge hole, in my opinion. There are still some people that are very successful with it, but that's because they have a great customer base that's been trained to, you know, they're activated by that email marketing. Ours aren't. No shade to any of you, but it's rare that we see any wine sales from our email campaigns. So we use them more as a newsletter. And sure, there's a wine offering or a vertical or like a library pack or something involved in there. And maybe we should do more like, you know, promotion of our wines via email. But historically, as the years have gone on, those sales have continued to decline. So we're trying to find ways like this podcast, more of a newsletter focused, you know, email campaign of connecting with people and doing something a little different than what most other wineries do, which is like, hey, look at this flash sale. We have this wine that we're long on inventory on. And if you order 6 bottles, we'll give you 20% off and all this other stuff. You know, that's not unique. That's not special. That's not interesting. Right? So we're trying to find ways to do something different, connect in a different way beyond just that immediate sale if we can. Because as important as sales are, you know, we also want to make sure that we have a great relationship with our consumers. That is what has kept us in business, and that's what's worked for us from a marketing standpoint. That might not work for everybody, but it works for us. So you got to figure out what works for you and go from there. All right, that has been the question and answer episode for June. We are halfway through this year, people. Not that you needed a reminder, but I'm here to give it to you. Thank you all so much for tuning in. Very excited for the next couple of episodes. We are going to be diving into a little bit more geeky winemaking detail. We've talked a lot about the business aspects of the wine industry for the first half of the year. And with harvest coming around the corner, we're going to start diving into a little bit more in the cellar type work. Between everything from wine phenolics and tannin structure to barrel selections and what we're looking for, blending. I am going to try to post a blending session. I'm going to literally take you into the cellar and walk you through a blending session. I don't know how exciting it's going to be. Maybe you'll find it interesting. It's going to be a lot of me tasting wine and making notes and hopefully explaining to you in a reasonable way, an entertaining way, that, you know, or somehow, like, this is what we do and this is what we go through when we're creating a blend. We're going to try and do that in a couple of weeks. So I hope you'll tune in for that. Thank you all so much. Again, follow us on our socials at MTGA Wines. Please remember Instagram and YouTube are the best places to check out new content. We are rarely on the Book of Face. We are somewhat active on the social network formerly known as Twitter. But anyway, if you have any questions that you want to throw into this Q&A at the end of the month, you can slide into our DMs. You can also head to our website, mtgawines.com, sign up for the newsletter. And down below, there's a little email form there that you can fill out and submit your questions as you see fit. Thank you all so much. Take care. Have a great rest of the week. And we will see you next time. Cheers.